I really like how it gets kind of quiet here. The flashbacks to when Eric is giving Shelley the ring. It goes from being a violent, brutal moment to being soft and very heartfelt, almost instantly, which is very difficult to pull off. It just shows you what a virtuoso that Alex Proyas is. And the idea that it was just a small, cheap ring because, they were just common people, they weren't rich. I like the idea that they stayed with that. Brandon had my sympathies with this scene because that gun weighed 60 pounds and he had to hold it up there straight for something like 10 takes. And you can even see his arm trembling a bit. The thing with him throwing the apple in the air is something that he came up with. He just brought so much to this that it can't be underestimated. Just the charisma and his personality, you can't help but feel for him. Someone told me that before they even knew about Brandon's death, it may have even been before he died. It was a rough cut, but they said that Brandon had a sense. He just gave off this sense of being doomed, and I can see what they were getting at. That it's almost like there's a consolation here, where he, it's almost like he realizes that this is his last film. And I'll tell you a little funny segment about that explosion in a minute. But I think Brandon just understood the character so much that. It just shows through in his movements, even when he has nothing to say. They used twice as much explosives in that pawn shop as they were supposed to because they wanted, a nice big fire explosion. So originally they were going to have a stuntman, but at the last second they decided we'll put a mannequin up there. And so they only had the funds to blow this thing up once. So they set the mannequin up there. They bolted him to the ground. Then they went over and put this cheap $4 fright wig on top of his head. About 4 seconds before Alex Proyas was about to start to roll film and hit the explosions, I said, maybe you should go over there and staple that wig down to his head so it doesn't blow off in the middle of the explosion. I mean, that would look kind of comical. So someone ran over there with a staple gun and actually stapled the wig down on the mannequin's head. It's a good thing that they did use a mannequin because it was totally engulfed in flame, and a stuntman would have been seriously injured. And here comes my famous cameo, my first and last time to be on film. There I am, the official looter. Basically, I had been standing around on the set, and they said, "Do you want to do something?" I said, "Sure." It pays $300 for you to run across the street with this TV. Well, they didn't tell me it was going to be a smoking hot TV melting and sticking to my arm, and that we were going to have to do it 6 times. But I'm still glad I did it because it kind of gave my stamp of approval to the film. I refused to do any walk-on parts in the other 2 films just because I wasn't behind them. Here is our star villain, Michael Wincott. I had actually seen Michael Wincott in a film called 1492, which came out in 1992, naturally, since it was the year of Columbus's discovery of America. There were like four Columbus films that came out at once. And Ridley Scott did one called 1492. And oddly enough, he's wearing the same wig. He played an Indian in the Columbus film. And I was just amazed. Every time he came on, his voice just rumbled the theater. And he virtually stole every scene from Gerard Depardieu. And I just thought, wow, he would make an amazing, amazing top dollar. But I thought, well, he's you know, this is a Ridley Scott film. He's got to be out of their price range. And they called me a couple weeks later and said, guess what? You know, we got Michael Wincott. And I was just, you know, I was overjoyed because he just has such presence, you know. He's made some amazing films, from Robin Hood to Romeo is Bleeding. You know, I haven't seen it in a film yet where I was disappointed by his performance. But I still think he looks best in this wig. Tony Todd adding a bit of class to the low-life criminals. Bai Ling has actually went on to do some, the Asian girl there has gone on to make some more high-profile films, which I can't think of at the moment, but, she has furthered her career in films. Poor Rochelle Davis did not know how to skate. I watched her, you know, night after night after night, skinning her knees and falling, and the poor girl, this was her first film, she would get up and apologize every time. And you know, I just have to give her credit for sticking in there. And her and Brandon had a real bond, I think. Brandon loved children. You know, in between scenes, we would, because it was freezing, we would gather around these burning drums, and he would all the crew members and cast members would have their kids on the set, and he would ask them what they want to be when they grow up. And he was just a very personable, charismatic person. You know, just very unassuming. This is just a little small added scene to add a little more depth to Ernie Hudson's character, Albrecht. For the people who don't know, his first name is Bernard in the book, Bernard Albrecht, which was a homage to one of the members of the band Joy Division. Hangman's Joke was a fictional band. They never recorded anything. The recording that's used in the film was actually done by Graham Revell, and I believe that's Graham Revell playing the guitar on the rooftop as well in a later sequence here. I thought all the shots with the crow flying over and through the city were just amazingly well done. Alex Proyas has his own commercial company in Australia called Meaningful Eye Contact. And he's filmed over 2,000 commercials, and I think his skill at quick cutting and you know, where to put the camera, the lighting, just how to make a scene work, really shows in all the work that he's put into these things. This was really a beautiful shot of Brandon, a nice hero shot, you know. I was continually amazed by these birds. That one, I believe his name was Omen. The trainer would tell him, you know, fly into the room, look around, pick at something and then fly off in another direction, and the damn bird would do it every time. They were more skilled than some of the actors. The whole idea of the character being a rock star was something that was added by the Hollywood element. I wanted Eric to be the common man. You know, I didn't want him to be anything special, and making him a rock star kind of elevates him above the common man. So in the book, he's an auto mechanic. He comes home with a lunchbox. You know, I didn't want him to be anything, you know, anything more than a common person who's just completely and totally in love with this woman. And I thought by adding the rock star element that it took a little something away from the character, I thought, as well as some of the supernatural elements that they added. This joke coming up was one of my favorites in the book, and I didn't think it'd actually make it into film, but it did. Like most of you, I didn't see the humor in that line either. One of those lines that clanks, but every film has one or two. Anna Thompson did an amazing job here. She's very good at going hypercritical, you know, at just bringing all those base emotions to the surface like that. This scene went on quite a bit longer than what you see here. This razor played a part in it. Brandon grabs the razor from her and throws it across the room. Later on, during this scene, Funboy wakes up from the shower, grabs up the razor, and there's a razor fight between him and Eric, where Funboy slashes up Eric's stomach and his chest, and especially his forearms, which is why he's wearing electrical tape in the scene following this. It was another one of those scenes that the MPA objected to. And I agree, it was very brutal, it was very violent. But, you know, I didn't think it went over the top. Just everyone was so sensitive to the violence in this film because of what had happened to Brandon. Which is understandable, but when it affects the film, it's great to have the sympathies there and that. But when it affects the film, you know, I think things like that need to be rethunk. They've been threatening for years to do a director's cut. The original Alex Proyas cut, which runs 11 minutes longer than the version you're seeing here. I believe, you know, like 10 3/4 of those minutes are action sequences, which is a shame because Brandon and his friend Jeff Amata choreographed all the fight scenes themselves, and he did virtually, I would say, 90% of his stunt work himself. He worked very hard, and he was very proud of his work in this. Tony Todd Grange comes up the stairs just in time to see Eric Brandon Lee leaving the scene of the crucifixion. The idea being that each of the bad guys was killed in a way that was familiar to him. The needles are supposedly in the outline of a crow on his chest. So it works in some sequences. In others, it takes a little squinting to pick it out. This was a scene that was largely improvised on the set between Ernie Hudson and Brandon. They had a really nice rapport, and Ernie Hudson, being the consummate actor, he has some really subtle body moves here that I think add a lot to the scene, like when coming up here, when Brandon hands him the beer, he's almost afraid to take it. He takes a step backwards. And it takes several moments for him to realize that this character is not here to hurt him, and that he just, you know, he wants, that Brandon, Eric, wants some answers about what happened that night, what this is all about. Brandon came up with some really, I thought, moving dialogue here that was very heartfelt. And as I've been reminded that phrase that nothing is trivial, especially where love is concerned, that, you know, nothing is trivial. You know, every moment is special, and, you know, you will never get that back. So enjoy, respect, and live to the fullest every moment you have with someone that you're in love with. The basic description on Brandon's grave is actually a quote from a book called The Sheltering Sky, where the gist of it is that we tend to take life for granted because we think of it as an inexhaustible well. And as such, we take all kinds of things for trivial, when in fact, you know, how many times will you wake up to see your lover's smile? How many times will you see a sunset? You know, maybe 12, maybe 13, and all for the rest of your life. You know, how many times will you get to smell your lover's hair or feel her, you know, her lips against your forehead? And these are just things that we take for granted, and we never should, because, you know, in a moment's notice, those things can be taken away from us forever. I know that for a fact. Brandon's fiance knows that for a fact. I think of all the time I wasted that could have been spent, you know, in as close as we can get in our mortal souls to heaven here on earth. They were wasted arguing over things that didn't matter. I mean, I think that is a fitting reminder. So if you're ever in Seattle, stop in and see Brandon and Bruce's gravesite. They're buried right next to each other, and it's a very moving experience. Tony Todd, I think, adds a lot of class to a lot of low-life characters in here. You know, he has a very commanding voice, a lot like, you know, a lot of the classically trained Elizabethan actors, Shakespeare actors. You know, and Michael Wincott is the first one to admit that his whole career comes from that pack of Camels he smokes every day. It's all in the voice. And actually, his brother has a bigger career than he does in Canada. He's much better known over there. You know, here he does guest spots on television shows and whatnot. Michael he's the older brother, but he's the lesser of the stars in overall, you know, being well known throughout the Canada and America. John Polito just plays the consummate slug. I mean, you know, you just I have never seen him play a likable character. He is always playing the low life. He's found his niche in the acting world. This guitar sequence was in actuality recorded by Graham Revell, who did the soundtrack. I think it adds a lot of atmosphere to the set, to the scene. There's a gorgeous overhead shot there of about $40 worth of cardboard models. He also does the voice and I believe plays all the instruments on the small segment of the song you hear here that skips. There was no actual album. It was just a prop which someone made off with. But I'm sure if you look hard enough on eBay, you'll be able to find it or reasonable facsimile. Crow props were going for an incredible amount of money after the film was released. And in fact, there's one guy in, I believe, Virginia who has virtually hundreds of thousands of dollars from the film clappers down to Brandon's jacket. Just an incredible collection. You know, these are all the same street, just slightly redressed. This upcoming sequence here was majorly edited. One of the producers thought it would be hilarious to have two 10-year-old kids come in with 44 Magnums and rob the place while Skank was in there. And just as to add an exclamation point to the scene, they shoot Skank in the shoulder on the way out. You know, fortunately, in in retrospect, whoever was making such decisions decided that it was incredibly poor taste to have these 10-year-olds come in and rob this convenience store. So the entire sequence was pretty much edited out. When a skank says, what, holy horseshit, or happy horseshit, that's when the two kids come in with the guns. And you could actually see one of them there in the background briefly. I always called Angel David, who played Skank, the Wile E. Coyote of the Crow, because he's continually getting fucked up and fucked over. Up, over, around, and again, and he keeps coming back for more. So he's the comedy relief, and I think it's something that's definitely needed with characters that are this close to the edge. This is one of those gratuitous scenes with the cops here that I wish had been edited out. I mean, it simply adds nothing to the film other than giving the cops speaking roles, which neither of them, I thought, deserved. Not to mention it wasn't even a funny scene. A lot of these chase scenes are done with little model cars on cardboard sets, and they're nearly indistinguishable from the real cars. Alex Proyas is brilliant at doing this type of thing. He sent me some samples of commercials that he had done that were filmed entirely with little model cars. And I swear I could not tell the difference in 99% of the shots. You know, he knows how to light them, the sound effects, the camera work. He's just brilliant with that type of thing. You know, when the T-Bird goes over the edge of the wharf, which there are no wharfs in Detroit, but that's another story. That's a model car, and unfortunately the whole front axle falls off, which is an impossibility on a front-wheel drive car like a T-Bird, but, you know, it looks nice. It's amazing. I love the ding, ding, ding here of the door being open. You know, that's just one of those little subtle things that Proyas puts in there to add realism. This is why David Patrick Kelly is one of my favorite artists. He had a chance in the early 70s. He was part of the punk movement with the Ramones and Blondie and the Talking Heads and Television, the bands that were coming out of New York. There was the David Patrick Kelly band, and he had to make a decision whether to go into film or into acting, and he flipped a coin, and it came up acting, so he followed that, and he's just an amazing actor. He does research. His brother passed away during the filming of this, and he went to England, and he knew a lot of the lines from the book came from Dante's Inferno, so he bought a first edition book in England there, and that's what he was reading from there in that little sequence to Shelley. And all of this, you know, is pretty much off the cuff. He's, you know, that there ain't no coming back, you know, that was all David Patrick Kelly just pulling it out of thin air, trying to make it as real as possible. Yes, that's a quote from Dante, from Milton, rather, from Dante's Inferno. You know, this is a model car going off the bridge. you know, this is always a fan favorite scene when the crow lights up. In actuality, it would take about 14 gallons of lighter fluid to actually make this crow, but it's still a beautiful scene sequence, and it has a lot of power. You know, this is, I thought this was kind of a gratuitous sequence. It wasn't necessary for Grange to visit the gravesite. And this is actually the only time Detroit is mentioned by name in the film. It's, you know, Motor City, among other things, but they never mention it as Detroit. And this is the only shot in the film that was filmed during daylight. The rest of the film was shot at night. And it's kind of a transitional sequence for Darla, for Rochelle Davis's character's mother. This is kind of a transitional point in the film to where the characters have grown from what they were in the beginning. You know, Eric has opened up their lives for them, showed them a different path, showed them that things don't have to be the way they are. He shows them that everyone has a choice. Marco Rodriguez, of course, a well-known B actor from X-Files to Star Trek. Doesn't add a whole lot to this film other than to give grief to the Ernie Hudson character. But Ernie Hudson gets a nice grin off of him for the audience for the sequence, and which makes him, you know, more of a likable character, and the audience identifies with him a lot more. Okay, we're going to pause here and change CDs. 1, 2, 3, pause.